Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. It's now my pleasure and honor to introduce Margaret Crahan, moderator of our panel discussion on Cuba. Dr. Crahan is a senior research scholar of the Institute of Latin American Studies at Columbia University, and is also one of the creative spirits responsible for today's program. She will introduce the other panelists.
It's a great pleasure to be here at the Commonwealth Club because I have heard about it repeatedly from my former student at Occidental College, Greg Dalton, who works here. I have the honor and pleasure of introducing our two speakers today. Our first will be Jorge Mario Sanchez Izoque, who is, in my mind, the leading economic analyst of Cuba. He is a full professor at the University of Havana, and he is a member of the Center for the Study of the Cuban Economy, and most recently was a visiting professor at Columbia University. Our second speaker will be Professor Philip Brenner, who is replacing Dr. Carlos Azugaray, who unfortunately was denied a visa by the U.S. government. However, Philip is the U.S.'s leading expert on U.S.-Cuban relations, so we are particularly happy to have him here. Jorge Mario will speak about the changes currently underway in Cuba, and Philip will talk about whether or not there will be changes in U.S. policy towards Cuba and Cuban policy towards the United States. Jorge Mario.
Well, many thanks for the invitation to be with you over here. Let me make first two warnings. As most of the Cubans, we literally smash any other foreign language. So please don't be afraid to make me a sign either to correct my English or just to ask me what I was saying. The second one is that since I didn't know the group's background, I will be referring to some topics that might be of a little bit technical approach. Therefore, I will turn on my face scanner, and depending on your reactions, I will be shrinking or expanding some of the topics. So basically, what I propose to you over here is a very compressed reference on what is going on into the Cuban economy today and why it is taking place. First, what is Cuba in the mind of probably all of you? Well, a sort of a coconut tree placed with gorgeous beaches and Fidel Castro, perhaps, and someone with a big cigar. And after that, it's difficult to see behind the curtain a living society and a very complex environment. Because of the first difference is that we didn't have a conventional Latin American economy or society you will find anywhere around Central America or the Caribbean. We came from 50 years of being inserted into the socialist environment. That means 84% of state ownership. When you have a single agent that regulates and decided everything, you have a different culture, a different pattern of behavior on planning institutions, and a way in which even citizens see their own future. That's why, in the case of Cuba, the private sector is not a compensating variable on decision-making, but a marginal one. And that makes a whole difference in the game. First, in the 90s, there was a process of opening the country of reforms after the collapse of the socialist bloc. Some seemed that was an unexpected event. No think tanks, no one in the world says that within the next three weeks, there won't be any more the Soviet Union. Well, how damaging was that for us? It was exactly the same of having an earthquake or a civil war. A contraction of economy of 33%. The U.S. crack on the 30 was only 30% in a far more sophisticated and dynamic economy. So we have a pretty hard landing in the 90s without the alternative you have in first world or sophisticated economies. Second, what are the main sources of economic activity in Cuba? Well, sure, export, of course. Everybody thinks about that early on. But after that, in the 90s, with the process of opening to foreign companies for investment new markets, we shifted from sugar to mojitos, that is, tourism. What happened with that change? It's a major structural change. Because in sugar, you have a sugar mill, alcohol, derivatives, and a whole wave effect from the agriculture to export companies and processing and manufacturing. But in the case of tourism, you only need a bartender, a taxi driver, and a hotel manager, and that's it. So from short term, just illustrating the fact that in tourism, the employment generation factor is quite limited. And so we have that structural change in such a way that it was quite useful in terms of short-term cash flow. To have more tourism, you just take an old building, you repaint it, refurbish, and you sell it the next 2 weeks. But it's not the same to recover 85% of trade or to substitute 92% of oil energy imports or to substitute 93% of fertilizers and herbicides, all the agriculture, or to substitute 52-53% of food provision. That's why we're so aggressive. The best way to illustrate, daily blackouts of 12-16 hours. Could you imagine in the Caribbean with the heat and the mosquitoes after 3 hours without a fan or an air conditioner? It's a nightmare, right? In other words, it was a shock on foreign trade that translated immediately into an emergency political emergency. Because of, doesn't matter your religious belief or your race or your political affiliation, everyone was hit by the shock. So what happened in the 90s was the reference of what is happening today. During the 90s, there was a process of opening to foreign companies, foreign investors that came because there was not enough reserve. We lost market, credits, and we came from a special bubble. We were making business speaking in, could you imagine, in Russian, Czechoslovakian, and German, and suddenly needed to speak Japanese, English, and French? So business culture was another important constraint. Because only around 15 to 20% of a Cuban foreign or international insertion was in the normal markets. So that process of readapting the country to a new environment created new tendencies on employment or economic activity. And that is the main reference of what we have today. A limited private sector, still a dominant state structure, although there has been a growing role for foreign investors in energy, telecommunications, port, airports, infrastructure, and that is what dynamized the Cuban economy during the 90s. But there was another new variable, that is remittances, money sent by relatives living here in the States mostly. That was a third source of income. And so we turned it to be a service economy from primary commodities, sugar, to service, tourism, and remittances. When your own is who is supporting your consumption, the incentive to work lowered. So there was a very disruptive, corrosive tendency to new forms of black market activities, private sector, not legal at that time, but also the scarcity of cash flow forces the government to legalize the use of dollars. In other words, dollarization of the economy. Two currencies circulating, which means two wage policy, two ways of financing economic activity, two headaches, and just one pill. So that's what happened in the 90s. It was successful in the sense of reactivating the economy, generating employment and other sources on the new basis, but also creating new problems. The dollarization of the economy, distorted incentive. The government created a mechanism to capture dollars from the street, those remittances, through dollar stores. And then they have capacity to provide credits to the entrepreneurial system to recover employment and production. Well, that's the background. In the 2000s, there was a second shift, early 2000, trade with the United States. In a very short period of time, through special license mechanism with the Treasury Department, in a very short period of time, the U.S. became the fourth provider of food for the Cuban economy, a major change. And I used to say that without signing a free trade agreement, we have exactly the same impact, the tortillas effect in Mexico. Opening the market to U.S. exporters of corn means that domestic producers were wiped out of this scenario because of lower competitiveness with the high subsidies of these super big American companies. We have the same with chicken, powdered milk, all the critical supplies for food. So one of the biggest problems we have today is the excessive, the hyper-exacerbated dependency on food imports, mostly from the United States. So on one hand, we have a positive story of increased exchanges on trade. The paradox is that in the second Bush term, right by the time when we have the worst political scenario, we have the highest exchange on trade. A completely crazy context. And Saudi is becoming a partner important in food imports, but also in tourism. And then appears to growth to a way in which last year there was a record, more than 190,000 American visitors and over 330,000 Cuban American visitors. American visitors are very limited because very few agencies have the license of travel service provider, very few. So the question is, how big is the potential for American visitors? How many people wanted to go to, I don't know, dance at Guantanamera or, you know, having a sunset? Well, there are only two official studies on the U.S. Congress and charged by the U.S. International Trade Commission, the minimum numbers, 171,000 to 1.1 million in the first year. That is, let me translate that into practical terms, an airplane with 312 passengers landing every 20 seconds. There is not enough parking lots, glasses for mojitos, people to play Guantanamera, and whatever you wanted to think about. It would be literally a touristic tsunami. So the question for us is from sugar to mojitos, from mojitos to more mojitos? Well, the problem is that the Cuban society has a very specific feature. After 50 years of free, full access to health and education, everyone is professional, or almost everyone is professional, because the only requirement is to pass the test. So in our case, the main difference from Latin America is that instead of lacking human capital, professionals, and trained people capacities, we have excess. You raise a stone and you have 10,000 doctors and engineers and you don't know what to do with them. So the question is how to manage an economy that is shifting toward service economy with low requirements on human capital and hundreds of thousands of engineers on telecommunication, specialists on biotech, and people capable to design software for pregnant mothers to treat disease prior to the birth. That is a challenge. It would be a huge mistake to waste those billions to turn everyone into mojito makers and taxi drivers. That was a challenge. So the U.S. becoming an important partner on trade, on food, and tourism. And another change that took place in 2004, relations with China and Venezuela. During the 90s, we have a strategic relocation of the Cuban international insertion toward the European Union and Canada as the main partners. And in the 2000s, China and Venezuela, government-to-government agreements, that is to say that they are protected from the volatility on the global markets. So we have certainty, high prices in some cases, but then they literally exploded. If you see the charts on the volume of trade and investment, the U.S., Canada, and the rest of the partners, the European Union, has been lowering their relative importance, not because they do worse. They keep the same level. It's because the other one multiplied per 10 the values of exchanges. So that geographical relocation of international relations means that we were, again, repeating an old mistake, excessive dependency from special conditions. And that's a new question we have to solve. So in the 2000s, China and Venezuela, a new prompts of integration within the Americas, and new sources of volatility. Over time, increased foreign debt because of food imports means that deterioration of domestic conditions of producing food. That is a main component of the current process of transformations. That is to produce incentive for the domestic production of food, that is passing property, the expansion of the private sector, allowing to have credits, reviewing and changing the prices paid to producers, incentive to the private sector and cooperative, that is to restructure the Cuban society from 84% of state ownership and employment to a higher role for the private sector. In the next 5 years, around 35% to 40% of the Cuban population will be relocated from the state post to private and cooperative and other state employments. So it's going to be a major adjustment. Another important feature, after so many years of free access to health, the Cuban population is exactly in demographic terms of any European advanced country, an aged population. So we have less and less people to work to sustain an aged family. But also in health, the requirement increases. You have more sophisticated equipment and medicines for an aged population. So we are facing a demographic crunch for the next 5 years. There's no capacity of population replacement. That's another big issue. So private sector, cooperative, relocation of trade and investment relations, and a process within the Cuban Communist Party and the parliament that is being named updating the socialist model, that is changing the rule of a game by introducing new incentives and dismantling regulations that blocked the economy. They are compressed on 313 guidelines is the name. That is the agenda for change, the official one approved in the Cuban parliament. And everything from now on is being referred to the guidelines. Whatever that happens, you have a call, it's about the guidelines number that. So the question is how to manage, first, political consensus to deepen the process. The faster they go, the higher the social cost in any way you move, either unemployment or in access to resources. We are shifting the country from subsidizing everyone to subsidizing only those who need it. So focalizing subsidies, reduction of state subsidies and structure, downsize of employment, those are the main components that you might find on the media. What is not very well publicized is the complexity of a decision-making process, the consensus building, higher role for the church, informal channels on the civil society, from bloggers to all kind of, there's a very wide spectrum of actors. So to summarize, new rules, new actors, new problems. So we are just in the early chapters of that TV soap opera. We still didn't know exactly what is going to work fine or become more complex. But definitely the country in the next 5 years won't be like the one you see today or the one that was during the 2000s. So summarizing, there has been two major structural shifts into the Cuban economy and society in the 90s and in the 2000s for different reasons. In the 90s, because of a shock on foreign trade that forced it to survive and adjust. In the 2000s, because of domestic failures, but it's also associated to a political change on reducing the state presence in the economy, less centralization, less vertical mechanism, more autonomy for the private sector, more local empowering of local communities. So this is what is happening already. You want to use two words? This de-estatalization of a society and decentralization of the decision-making process. Thank you very much.
Let me thank the Commonwealth Club, particularly Christina Nemeth and Dr. Crahan for organizing this session. Let me tell you that the origin of this session comes about from a three-year project that the three of us have been involved in called TASE. By its Spanish acronym, it's the Taller Académico Cuba y Estados Unidos, the Academic Workshop on Cuba and the United States. And the purpose of that, we've now had six meetings together over 3 years. The purpose was to bring together Cubans and Americans to try to think outside the box, because what has happened in our 53-year relationship since the Cuban Revolution has been what one of the members of the group has called Sisyphus-like behavior, where you roll the stone up the hill only to have it reach the top and come down the other side, a repetition of moving one step forward and two steps back. Our goal is to try to stop that. And we found that the greatest source of that problem is distrust. On the Cuban side, distrust of the United States for 104 years, and on the U.S. side, distrust of Cubans for about 53 years. Let me give you a sense of this by starting with a story. In August of 1961, there was a meeting of the Organization of American States in Punta del Este, and the purpose of the meeting was for the United States to try to remove Cuba from the Organization of American States, because Cuba had now become too revolutionary. It had embraced the Soviet Union to some extent. This was after the Bay of Pigs. And one of the people we sent, the White House representative, was Richard Goodwin. And one of the people the Cubans sent was Che Guevara. President Kennedy told Dick Goodwin that in no way should he talk to any Cubans at this meeting. And he followed suit, but then the meeting ended in failure for the United States. We weren't able to kick Cuba out of the OAS at that meeting. And But Che Guevara wanted to talk to Richard Goodwin. And so he arranged with the Brazilian ambassador to have a party after the meeting. And that when Goodwin would come to the party, Che Guevara would be notified, and he would come to the party. And Goodwin's at the party, and he gets a cigar and a note from a messenger during the party that says, "I'm in the back room. I'd like to talk to you. There are more cigars where this came from." Goodwin goes into the back room, and Che Guevara is sitting in a lotus position, he's in a T-shirt, and Goodwin, he's manly, he says, "I can do this," and he takes off his jacket and tie, and he sits down in a lotus position. They talk for several hours, and we have the memorandum that Goodwin wrote to President Kennedy after that meeting, and he describes all of this, and his analysis is that this wouldn't have happened if the Soviets were giving the Cubans what they needed. Therefore, the Cubans are at a moment of vulnerability. Let's crush them now. Wow, what a lost opportunity. But it, in many ways, really was an evidence of misunderstanding about what Cuba was about, and that you could simply crush them, what the Cuban-Soviet relationship was about. And from the Cuban side, they saw it as yet another failed opportunity by the United States, but it was really a failed opportunity by a person, not by the United States, but it accumulated over time. And you know the metaphors that we use, both countries use metaphors that reinforce the problem. Think about the dominant metaphor that Cuba uses to describe the relationship. I'm sure you all know it. It's David and Goliath, right? Big country, little country. And Jose Marti famously said that we are the sling of David against the Goliath, the United States. Well, you know, the metaphor is an interesting metaphor. People laugh, but ultimately, what does David do to Goliath? He kills him, right, with his slingshot. That's not a very friendly metaphor, right? It's not something you use to open up a relationship, right? And yet the Cubans don't quite appreciate that, although Fidel Castro has said that we don't mean to destroy the United States. We want to destroy the American empire. But for the United States, that means bringing down the greatness of the United States. Part of our identity, as we wouldn't call it empire, part of our identity is to have global responsibilities. And so they are attacking the very identity of the United States. What's our metaphor? It's not one that we commonly think of. It's Gulliver. Now, many of you may remember the story of Gulliver and the Lilliputians as Gulliver is being tied down on the beach by these little people. But if you go back and read Gulliver's Travels, in fact, as he is on the beach, knocked out from his shipwreck, and these little people are running over him, and he's tied down, he realizes that he actually can break loose one of his arms, and that he does, and they don't realize it. And he thinks to himself, you know, with one swat, I could just kill hundreds. But I won't do it. I'm too noble a person to do this. I will instead use my great power to teach them how to behave responsibly. And the rest of that story, which is part of Gulliver's Travels on the island with the little people, is how he doesn't let them use his great strength to kill the Brobdingnagians, or whatever they were called. They want to use him to. And he teaches them civilization. Well, that's our attitude about Cuba, that we could, of course, crush Cuba if we wanted to, but we don't. Look at all the good we try to do. This brings us right up to the present moment. Think about the case of Alan Gross. Some of you may have heard about this case. It figures very much into U.S.-Cuban relations because Alan Gross was, the United States government says, stands in the way of, at the moment, improved relations. Alan Gross was a subcontractor for the United States Agency for International Development. And his job was to go and bring communication equipment into Cuba. The Ostensibly, what he claimed he was doing, who could argue with? He was trying to help the Jewish community, about 1,500 people in Cuba, get better access to the Internet. Frankly, that seems like a reasonable thing to do if that were truly his intention. There are some problems with the story, and that is that the Jewish community didn't ask for this. They have access to the Internet. And what he was bringing to them was satellite equipment that included a SIM card available only to our intelligence community or to the Department of Defense, a SIM card, like your telephone SIM card, but this SIM card would prevent detection of the equipment for a radius of 250 miles, so that you would not be detected if you were using this satellite equipment. Now, I don't know what the Jewish community wanted to communicate with each other. Maybe the matzo ball recipe. But I don't think that that's what they needed. They didn't need such secrecy. They are not dissidents in the way that they have. But a real spy, someone who might want to, in fact, harm Cuba, could, with only knowing the password to that satellite communication equipment, could, in fact, lock into that and then send signals to dissidents, send signals to the United States, so that, in fact, it would be truly work of someone engaged in espionage or worse. So the Cubans treat this very seriously. And Alan Gross is in prison for 15 years. The United States' position is he committed no crime. Now, we know he clearly committed a crime. He came as a tourist, and no country is a tourist allowed to do this kind of thing. So that, at a minimum, if a French person came to the United States and did this, they would have committed a crime. And the typical penalty is a fine or maybe deportation. He got 15 years. I think he got too much. But we won't acknowledge that he even committed a crime. Privately, we do. But publicly, we will not say he committed a crime. And this infuriates the Cubans. They say, how can you... In fact, this is a person who, in fact, potentially was harming Cuba. And, in fact, you won't even acknowledge that danger. Don't tell us you were here to help us. This was done under a project to change the Cuban regime. And so that kind of lack of understanding, where we say it's only for the good of the Cuban people we want to do this, and they say, but what you're really doing is something quite else. And they, in turn, say things that attempt to undermine the U.S. position in the world. And they say, we're just fighting the U.S. empire. And we say, well, you're really undermining what the United States... Neither side has the ability to empathize with the other. So the purpose of the TASE project was to try to get over that hump. There is, in fact, a lot of interaction between Cuba and the United States today that you may not realize. For example, since 1997, Cuban military and U.S. military have been meeting at the fence line at Guantanamo monthly to talk about problems that might arise, because there are mines there. There are mines in the water. There are mines at the fence line. Neither wants any trouble. And so the militaries talk about how to protect each other's interests. We have cooperation on hurricane warnings. We have cooperation on oil drilling. Both countries are now involved in multilateral meetings to talk about problems that might arise from drilling in the Gulf. Cuba is starting to test for oil in the Gulf. They may have as much as 20 billion barrels in reserve in the Gulf and undersea that's on their territory. So this could be a very large, that's larger than U.S. reserves, by the way. So this could be a very big game changer. But we are talking about that. But none of the discrete projects seems to multiply, seems to spill over to anything else to build goodwill. So the goal here was to try to find ways to do that. We brought together largely former diplomats or people who had been in the government and could understand their own government's way of thinking, and so we understood what was realistic, because we can all come up with pie-in-the-sky ideas to say, oh, why don't you try this? But we wanted realistic proposals, and proposals that people who had served in the government or were close to the government, someone like Carlos Alzugaray, who had been the ambassador to the European Union and for 30 years was in the Ministry of Foreign Relations. He's now a professor at the University of Havana. And on our side, for example, the former National Security Advisor for Latin America, Richard Feinberg, or the former Director General of the Foreign Service, Anthony Quinton. In fact, Anthony Quinton was the person who put Cuba on the list of terrorist states when he was the coordinator for counterterrorism in the State Department. And so these are people who understand their own governments and want to search for ways that would build confidence. So that was our goal. We came up with a series of modest proposals that we released on Monday at a meeting in Washington. And they're quite undramatic. To get to the point of these common proposals was quite incredible, I must say, even for something not very dramatic. But it showed that it was possible to talk to each other. It was possible to try. If there was goodwill, it would be possible. And you say, well, where is the goodwill? I say the goodwill may not exist today as much as it may in just a few short years. Cuba is changing dramatically. The face of Cuba is someone like Raul Castro or the Vice President Machado Ventura. One is 81, one is 82. But the real policy, the real political future of Cuba resides in something like the Central Committee of the party. The average age is 44. Right? Or in the party leaders in the provinces where the average age is 46. That's the future of Cuba. And in the United States, it's the Cuban-American community of a new generation who don't harbor the ancient hatreds against Fidel Castro and Raul Castro, who are prepared to now move on and talk about their own lives either in the United States without an obsession about Cuba or with a concern about the country of their origins rather than a focus on those leaders. And the consequence is, I think, the future, the not distant future, opens the possibility. But it's up to us, I think, to push the process of generating that goodwill just a little bit. Thanks.
We now have, if I read this correctly, 27 minutes for questions. We will take several questions at once, three questions at a time, to maximize the thing, if that's all right.
We have a static microphone here, and if you will please use the microphone.
These are on?
Yeah, they're on.
Okay.
So first, I'm going to say that I'm Cuban-American. I left Cuba in 1989, and I'm happy to be here. This morning, about 10 minutes to 6 o'clock in the morning, somebody called me in my house. The telephone rang. I start ringing. I said, oh, my God, what happened? Somebody from Miami was calling me, and they say, Mariela Castro is in San Francisco. I want you to give us an interview against her. You know, there were people protesting there. What do you know about? I don't know how they found my phone number, but, you know, in Cuba, in Miami, everybody talked, and I said to the person who called me, I said, well, I think it's, you know, I'm also a gay male, and I think I'm happy that she's here. She should have come. Actually, she should come every other day to San Francisco, to the United States. If you want to record that conversation with me, you can put it on the radio station, Radio Mambi in Miami, and you're going to be killed maybe by the Cubans in Miami. But I'm not telling you anything against her. That was one point. That was my first take this morning. My question is, what is going to happen if Obama wins a second term this year in November, which I know he will? And before, during the Bush administration, as a Cuban-American, my father was very ill, and I wasn't allowed to go to Cuba every year to see my father who was dying. So I had to lie to the government of the United States, then fly from here to Toronto, from Toronto to Havana, or from here to Mexico City, and from Mexico City to Havana. Then when I was coming back to the United States, they asked me, where are you coming from? And I said, well, I'm coming back from Canada. Hey, I was lying. I was coming back from Cuba. Then the government of my country, which is this also, they were forcing me to lie. The second part of the question is, what happened to the Cubans in Miami? Why is that hatred? Why they keep doing all of this, the Republican, like Ileana and the people in Congress? Why is it going to happen? Why are they doing this? My generation is different. I was born during the communists. You know, I grew up. I went to University of Havana. I left Cuba in 89, but my mentality is totally different. I want us to be together, and I want the peace.
Thank you. Next question.
My question concerns the Cuban Five, and I'm wondering whether you feel that they would be a bargaining chip for the release of Alan Gross, at least a new fair trial, if not release. What's your take on that? Yes.
Next question, and then we'll have some responses.
Seeing that what happened in Russia, the sort of rapacious capitalism that galloped in and set up the oligarchs, how might you protect Cuba from that type of economic change? And I'd also ask about the sustainability issues, how you have been so good with, like, organic farming, and how could you protect that as well? Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Phil, do you want to begin? And Jorge Mario?
Well, I applaud your statement. Let me tell you that Mariela Castro was Raul Castro's daughter and the head of Center on Study of Sexuality, and has been a leader in the fight against HIV, AIDS, and for the rights of the gay, lesbian, transgender community. She has had several death threats against her. I was with her last night as the Secret Service was working to protect her, informing her of several of the death threats against her life while she is here. And this is outrageous. So what the gentleman says is really quite serious. I would say that there's a big change in the Miami community, but there's an industry that thrives on getting money, receiving money from the U.S. government. People like Ileana Ross Litinen put money into programs that money then gets spent on these people, and it's like patronage. So until that stops, and I think that might stop in a second Obama administration, the question that would certainly help would be if the Cuban Five were exchanged for Alan Gross. Let me say something about that. The Cuban Five are five people who were arrested in a group of 14 Cuban agents who were sent to the United States largely to spy on terrorists in the United States who were attacking Cuba. And they were attacking Cuba. There were bombs that were set off. There was an Italian tourist who was killed. There were Cubans who were injured. When we think about the terrorism against other countries, we talk about wanting to do something about that kind of terrorism. We would hold up people who were trying to stop that as heroes. In Cuba, these people are held up as heroes. The United States and Cuba were working together in the late 1990s, and Cuba learned a lot about the terrorists, gave information to the FBI, invited the FBI to come to Havana, and the FBI, on the basis of the information that they received about terrorism in South Florida, arrested the people who were the agents learning about the terrorism, not the terrorists. You can imagine how terrible Cuba feels about this. There were some who fled before they were arrested. Some pleaded guilty. Five didn't. The sentences for the five ranged from 15 years to two life sentences. They were convicted of espionage. They were not convicted of any crime because there was no crime that they could be pinned to. They were convicted of espionage, and largely this was espionage against Cuban terrorist groups in the United States, Cuban-American terrorist groups. And so it was a trial in Miami that was clearly fraudulent. There were Cuban-American thugs sitting in the audience, glaring at the judge and glaring at the jury. a motion to move the trial elsewhere was turned down. Amnesty International has taken up this case and says it was a fraudulent trial. The Cuba says there is not a parallelism, that Alan Gross committed real crimes, and the Cuban Five did not commit real crimes. They committed the crime of not filing as agents of a foreign government. It's the only crime that they committed, which is a minor crime. But the reality is that there could possibly be an exchange. President Obama could do it by declaring clemency or not even a pardon. He could commute their sentences, but I don't think that would happen until after an election. So it's a possibility after an election. Though the Cuban government publicly says they wouldn't like this, I think privately they would be willing to do that. I'll let you answer the question about the economy.
Yes, so. Let me start first with the Cuban-American community. There is a very sad heritage of mistrust. Cuban-American community has changed deeply in the past 15 years. Cuban-Americans not only travel very often to Cuba, but also support their relatives, but also today are becoming micro-investors. They're putting the starting capital for all the new businesses that are not all, but an important part in the cities that is starting to appear in the past year, year and a half. So they're taking new roles. And you know what? The government is supporting, is encouraging. They are invited to be part of the process of changes into the country. The thing is that there are a clear difference between all those generations, as yourself and many others, and half of my classmates, half of my neighborhood, or my own family, that emigrate for several reasons, mostly economic, also for political difference, but they didn't take a stand in the agenda of imposition, aggressiveness, or selling a country without no relation at all with the reality. So the gap between the first generation of emigres and the last three, four wave, according to Florida International University, pointed to a very important process. There's a dual pattern of voting. In Miami, in the local elections, you see that most of the issues about Cuba remains in the hands of the hardliners. While when it comes a time to vote in practice, people take their plane ticket and went to Cuba. So that's a very important issue because it means that the people that have a capacity, the leverage capacity to exercise politics or to block initiative do not represent the majority. They claim to do it, but they didn't. This is in the words of the Cubans that live in the States. The second point about the economic changes, and it goes from there to the urban gardening and the rest. The economics are a strategic need because a system has good achievements in the sense of human development index, access to health and education, but it was dysfunctional and unsustainable in economic terms. It means that you have people educated with medical coverage, but the economy is accumulating every year more and more foreign debt because the only way to keep those services is through subsidies. If you didn't generate enough income, you rely on credits. So that vicious circle, the only way to break it is by introducing new dynamics in the economy. So the process of reform goes to reducing the state presence in the economy, but also boosting the private sector and one of the areas, in the case of food production, including urban gardening. The thing is that you could have more lettuce, more tomatoes, but that doesn't mean you have more proteins. And there's a difference when you have pregnant mothers and you need proteins. A healthy meal doesn't mean that with vegetables you solve everything. So yes, it is true there is a more awareness about the environmental concern. Cuba is being awarded by the United Nations as the second best country in the world on introducing practices on urban gardening. It's impressive the effectiveness they reach in a very short period of time with a very limited amount of resources. But that is not the main issue. It's substitution of food imports. Powdered milk, cooking oil, proteins in any form. So that goes from having fish gardens, special plants for that, because of a Cuba fleet for fishery in Africa and in the Americas has been literally completely obsolete. Over time, after 20 years without investment and repairs, no point. So to some extent, I'll use to refer to the example of an all-American cars, those who still see running Havana. Well, it's a miracle they're still running, right? They are gremlins. Inside they have Soviet spare parts and Japanese new one. That's a monument of a creativeness of the Cubans and the resilience, right? But it's also a monument of a lack of capacity to do things in a way that is sustainable, because it's patching, it's fixing. So what is happening now is changing the fundamentals. Instead of distorted incentive to remove barriers to push the economy in different directions. That goes from urban gardening to the private sector to other forms of organization. And then we have another important new development. During the 90s, foreign investment came to tourism, infrastructure. There were four areas forbidden: the army, education, health, and agriculture. There are proposals already being discussed on opening agriculture to foreign investment. And there are projects already in place with Brazilian capital. There are others of shared markets with other countries in Latin America. So definitely it's moving. The issue is that it's very challenging, because any movement, we didn't have money for a second shot. If it fails, you have a very important social cost. So it has to be managed carefully. That's why the prevailing mentality is going gradually. So the challenge is between the need for change and the speed of those changes. So just to conclude the idea, economic change are there to stay. But there is a process of learning curve on dealing with new things, new incentive, new management of credits, new opening to foreign companies in some areas. So all this in a context in which there is no expertise at all. That include oil offshore in the Gulf, which is a very big issue, by the way. But from the Cuban perspective, there is no doubt on the willingness to push forward, and that is what is count. With the participation of all the spectrum of the society, all kind of religious group, the immigration, all the forces that could boost for a better opportunity for the country and the well-being of everyone without caring about race or religious or ideological positions.
Let me just comment on two of the questions. One about whether or not Cuba, with the expansion of the private sector, might move in the direction of the type of capitalism that has developed in the former Soviet Union. That is a real issue that is in the minds of people who are working on developing not only the economic plans in Cuba, but also strengthening the rule of law. It will be absolutely critical as this process moves forward that the judiciary and other aspects of the system, including internal controls within ministries, are fortified so that you do have a stable system in which the rule of law will govern not only criminal activity, but also activity with respect to the tremendous expansion of the private sector in the future. So that is something that is in their minds, et cetera, and hopefully it will transcend some of the problems that have cropped up in the former Soviet Union. With respect to the question about what will happen in the second Obama administration, if there is one, in 2004, I organized a meeting of all of the U.S. reps who had engaged in formal or informal conversations with Cuba from 1960 through the Clinton administration, starting with Senators Aberesk and McGovern. And it is fascinating. The people who came from the Clinton administration thought that in the second administration of Clinton, there would be some major changes with respect to relations with Cuba, but other things, particularly scandals, intervened. In terms of those who participated in the Carter administration, they had plans to make some changes with respect to relations with Cuba, but as you know, Carter did not have a second term. Even the Ford administration people felt that they would also have made some changes, but they didn't get the opportunity. I am somewhat pessimistic. There's a lot of expectations that Obama might make some substantial changes, not minor changes, substantial changes in his second term. I'm somewhat pessimistic. Why? Because the House of Representatives will probably remain in the House or in the hands of the Republicans. As Phil mentioned, Ilhan Ross-Leighton, who's very strongly opposed to any relaxation of relations with Cuba, is the chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee, and she and a number of her colleagues are unlikely to agree to anything like that. Obama has to weigh what Ilhan Ross-Leighton wants in terms of Cuba against what she's willing to support the president on in terms of the Middle East policy, relations with Russia, et cetera, so that Cuba not being a major priority, the Middle East, Russia, et cetera, being priorities, you're going to have this disequilibrium in terms of the decision-making with respect to Obama, if he is in the White House, and a Republican-controlled House of Representatives. And that is my opinion on it, on the chances. Let's take three more questions very briefly.
The other side of the coin would be, what if we had 4 years of Romney, and what would the action be?
You can answer that. Okay. Yes.
We've maintained the economic embargo for 50 years. I'm not sure what our purpose was. So I would like to know why are we maintaining the embargo and what would have to occur before we would lift it.
Okay. Next. I'm going to take all of these people and we'll answer briefly.
In light of the recent papal visit to Cuba, would you please address the impact of that visit upon the possibility for expanded religious freedoms?
This is about the Pope's visit?
Yeah, religious freedom.
Okay.
Okay. Yes.
Could you comment on the economic impact the American embargo is having? When I visited, I heard a lot of negative, said it was a major issue. I'm not sure whether it is or not, other than my inability to get good cigars. And, you know, what does Cuba have if things are liberalized, that out correctly, by both the U.S. ending the embargo and changes domestically? What do they have in the way of export industries besides rum and cigars? And related to that, I want to ask you about the potential for biofuel, which I understand is most economically made out of sugar. Cuba used to be good at growing sugar.
We don't have time for more.
Thank you. If you can be exceptionally brief, we'll take your two questions. Go ahead.
Our group stayed at the Park Central, and they had flags from all the countries in the world, including ours.
Yes.
I have the distinction. My mother was born the day after the battleship Maine was blown up in Havana Harbor, and mother's no longer with us. I visited Cuba briefly about 60 years ago when it was a one-day trip, and it was like riding the bus. It was very, very simple. I also went over about 10 years ago. Colin Powell said yesterday he can't figure out why Gitmo, Guantanamo, hasn't been closed. What's the future of Guantanamo?
Okay. Why don't you answer Romney and Guantanamo?
Okay, we have 5 minutes.
I'll do the
Governor Romney has said that he would he'd go back to the Bush administration regulations and make them even tougher if he were elected. His advisor in Latin America has said that too. So we know what Governor Romney's position would be. Why the embargo for 50 years? The embargo was started as part of a covert operation called Operation Mongoose that had many different parts. Part of it was terrorism. Part of it was to strangle the Cuban economy. It was imposed specifically to strangle the Cuban economy. When it failed, it kept going to be used as a bargaining chip. And in fact, parts of the embargo have been lifted at times and parts have been added at times. So there's not a singular embargo. I would say one of the most difficult parts that we don't think about is the fact that Cuba is on the list of terrorist states, and for no reason at all. The first reason given is that they have been critical of the United States war on terrorism, they and 191 other countries. So it's not a serious reason, but it's hard to take them off politically, and that has impact on banking regulations. And so that actually is an even greater impediment in some ways. I'll let Jorge Mario talk about the impact of the embargo. Let me say something about Guantanamo. We acquired Guantanamo under the Platt Amendment in that we required Cuba to put in their constitution in 1903. We then abrogated that Platt Amendment in 1933. At that moment, we had Guantanamo for a 99-year lease. 1934, we essentially forced Cuba to issue us a new lease on Guantanamo for perpetuity. Forever. And even though we have no real need there except to harbor people we capture in other places of the world and try them, and no military people think we have any need for it, politically it is a hard thing for us to give up.
Okay, very briefly, main exports today of Cuba, the way in which Cuba connects with the world, is service economy, tourism, and medical service, that is doctors and supporting personnel providing service. There's at least 120 countries, but Venezuela, Bolivia, a little bit of Brazil, and Ecuador accounted for the big part in Latin America. But Venezuela is really the elephant. So medical service export, tourism, nickel. And let me point something very important with regard to the embargo impact. It's not about the number. The number is $68 billion, the accumulated. It's that only 10% of water in this glass means that automatically it's banned in any market in the world because it's of Cuban origin. So if you export nickel and the Japanese boat, and with nickel, what those people did? Medical equipment, airplanes, and everything else. But if it has 10% of Cuban content, it's banned. So it's a very damaging impact, inhibiting exports so as investment. It's a pretty high cost. And so the impact of the embargo has to be seen in two levels. The direct cost on what is known as a country risk profile. Any country in the world, that is, or any bank related to Cuba, is subject of having to pay a fine or for trial in the U.S. court. USB Bank had paid last year $100 million just for having Cuban assets in dollars. Cuba sells cigars, they store the dollars on that bank, and they have to pay. So that's why any other foreign partners tend to hide the links with Cuba passing through a second or third bank, and you know that that multiplies the fees and the cost. When we have a hurricane in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, they recover in 3 years. We need 5 to 8 years because we have to pay double, triple on interest rates. Instead of 9 to 10%, we pay 25%. So we have less disposable income just because of that. So it's higher prices because of the only way people will sell you things or invest in your country is because you pay double, triple. So higher cost on normal transaction, inhibiting investment and trade relations. So all this contaminated everything. So that's why the Cuban tendency is to support South-South kind of arrangements, not only with China and Vietnam, but with Brazil and other countries. So Canada and Europe remains important partners, but the key feature is that a high concentration of foreign relations in three countries, Venezuela, China, Spain, and the United States.
Thanks. On the papal visit and religious freedom, I was present for both the visit of John Paul II in 1998, as well as for the visit of Benedict XVI this past March, and have briefed the U.S. bishops on occasion about the situation in Cuba. Basically, the Cuban church has moved from the margins into the mainstream in the last 15 years. all religions in Cuba have increased their membership, particularly since the late 1980s, because there is a definite search for spiritual sustenance on the part of many Cubans, including particularly young people who are afflicted with alienation and anomie to a certain extent. Religious freedom in Cuba has increased, particularly since the 1980s. The restrictions on high-level positions that were imposed originally were eliminated in the early 1990s, and all of the religions in Cuba feel that they have made substantial progress in terms not only of being able to work with their own communities, but to occupy a major political and social space within Cuban society today, particularly given the changes that are underway. And so if you talk to the leadership of all of the religions in Cuba today, they are very hopeful and supportive of the economic reforms. They hope they will be accompanied by substantial political and civil reforms, and they are all committed to supporting the government efforts in this. And they do not identify with those who want regime change in Cuba today. Thank you very much.
A reminder that you've been listening to a Commonwealth Club panel discussion on U.S.-Cuba relations and the Cuban economy. And our thanks to our three panelists, Jorge Mario Sanchez Alcuzequi of the University of Havana, professor at its Center for the Study of the Cuban Economy, and to Philip Brenner, professor at School of International Service at American University, and Margaret Crahan, senior research scholar at the Institute of Latin American Studies, Columbia University. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, enjoying its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.